The Guardian. I'm Camilla Ruse, and you are listening to Science Weekly. Coming up...
Observing atoms at work is a formidable challenge. It's like looking at a moving golf ball on the surface of the moon from the Earth.
I'll be talking to the winner of this year's L'Oréal UNESCO for Women in Science Award, Professor Pratibha Ghai, whose work on microscopes has opened up the atomic world. Also...
Exploring another planet is an amazing feeling.
Ahead of his Royal Society of Chemistry lecture in London, I speak to Paolo Belluta from NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab about his role in the Curiosity rover mission on Mars and how he got his interplanetary driving license. And I'll be joined by scientist and journalist Maria Bocharova to take a look at this week's science news, including insights into dinosaur embryos and the ongoing battle of Professor David Nutt to carry out research into psychedelic drugs. I'll also be talking to The Guardian's Oliver Wainwright about the dawn of 4D printing. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Last August, the Curiosity rover made a daring landing into the Gale crater on Mars. Since then, the rover has been trundling over the Martian landscape, carrying out some startling science. Curiosity is, of course, the work of NASA's Mars Science Laboratory and its Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined on the line by one of the senior engineers on the project. Well, Paolo, it's lovely to speak to you. You have what you call an interplanetary driving license. Can you tell me what that means and how I can get one, please?
So there is a small group of people in the world that have an interplanetary driver's license. So we drive vehicles specifically on Mars. We have been trained to be able to drive, to move vehicles on Mars. We have sent to Mars, NASA has sent to Mars, three classes of vehicles and four vehicles in altogether.
I mean, I imagine driving the rover is not just a matter of fiddling around with a steering wheel. How do you drive one of these things?
We don't actually have any steering wheels or joysticks. Since the time delay between when we send the command up to the time that the vehicle receives the signal, it takes a minimum of 5 minutes and up to 20 minutes. We cannot really drive these vehicles interactively. So what we do, we use a series of simulators to simulate the commands, the execution of the commands, and then we send those commands in one batch. And then the vehicle receives the commands and executes them. And in later afternoon, what the vehicle does is sends the results. We look at the results and we decide what to do on the next day.
You test the commands before you send them out. How do you do that?
We take pictures of the terrain surrounding the vehicle. And we analyze the terrain and decide where the vehicle can safely drive. Then we combine this with the request from the scientists, the geologists, and decide where there is a potential science target and decide what is the best way to follow to reach those targets. And then we send appropriate commands to the vehicle to reach those locations by keeping the vehicle safe.
So Mars, the Martian landscape is obviously very different to our own. So how do you plan for all the kind of things that could go wrong during these driving exercises?
The main component of my job is being a pessimist. You try to analyze the terrain, and which is very similar to a desert. So there are no plants, of course, and the type of obstacles that you need to see are rocks, ditches, ledges, and potentially craters and loose sand. Probably that is the most tricky type of obstacle that you have to find, because loose sand looks almost exactly the same like compacted sand. Loose sand you can get in a quagmire, while on compacted sand is a perfect driving surface.
Okay, so what other challenges does the Mars rover have to deal with while it's there?
There are several potential hazards. first of all, the Martian environment is quite hostile. There is radiation. There are really cold temperatures between, let's say, a really torrid summer day can get up to plus 5 centigrade. But during the nighttime and in wintertime, it can go down to minus 90. So it is pretty cold, and we need to maintain the vehicle at a temperature because electronic components and mechanical components really cannot survive at those temperatures. All the things that we have to deal with are, let's say, potential malfunctions of the vehicle. If there is damage to the vehicle because of wear and tear, we need to find alternative means to accomplish the same things that the vehicle is designed for. So there are a few challenges, but these are the fun part of my job.
So you're the voice of doom then in the office. You're thinking of all the things that could go wrong and how to get out of those things.
Yes, exactly. That's where our ingenuity really shines, trying to solve these really weird problems that nobody has had to find a solution for.
And Curiosity was larger than the other rovers. Did that present new challenges?
The major challenge was, of course, landing on Mars, since the vehicle has is much wider and heavier than the previous vehicle, so we had to devise a different landing method. But once landed, the vehicle is bigger and therefore can drive over larger obstacles. It can still drive on slopes that are very similar to what the previous vehicles were able to drive on, but mostly this vehicle is more capable. It can drive on tougher obstacles, and the software that we have on board is much more sophisticated, and therefore they are easier to drive than the previous vehicle.
You seem to be facing all kinds of interesting challenges in having to drive on another planet. When you were starting out in science, is this what you thought that you were going to do in your career? Is this what you would have liked to do?
No, definitely not. when I was a kid, I was seeing on TV, for example, the Viking landers, and I thought that they were really, really cool, but I never imagined that I was going to end up working on Mars. But when I saw the potential of getting a job at JPL, I took that that challenge, and I'm holding really, really tight on this job. It is a really an interesting job. Exploring another planet is an amazing feeling.
Sadly, Paolo's lecture at the Royal Society of Chemistry here in London is already sold out, but there will be a live stream of the lecture on their website. That's rsc.org. You can also go to our blog to find a link to the live stream at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Now it's that time in the show when we take a look at some of this week's big science news stories. Joining me to do that is scientist and journalist Maria Bocharova. Welcome back to the podcast, Maria. Now let's kick off with your story, and starting off with a controversial scientist and some sort of psychedelic drug.
Right. In particular, something called psilocybin, which is a type of psychedelic substance. And the story is about the fact that it might be useful in treating depression, potentially.
I get the feeling David Nutt is going to come into the story.
Yes.
Soon.
How did you know? So, yes, exactly. So David Nutt is someone who's always been a tiny bit controversial in his views of drugs. And in particular, this kind of association between psychedelic drugs and depression is something that's been researched by him a little while ago. So about a year ago, actually, he came up with this finding. But the point that he's been making, particularly this week, has been the fact that he's trying to do some further research on this substance, and he's trying to actually use it to treat some people with depression who haven't been able to respond to other treatment. And he's finding it incredibly difficult to get through the legislation and the sort of licensing that is required in order to use these drugs anywhere at all, even for research. And so he, in his words, he's trying to fight against the archaic set of laws that we have in this country. He would like to test these drugs in 30 patients that have depression, and he's been given about £500,000 to do that. But it turns out that with all the licensing, he's going to have to pay something like $100,000 of that.
Just to get the drugs, which
is an enormous sum, especially as he says, the drugs themselves cost something like a couple of £100, which is nothing really. Most of that is going to have to go on basically finding a company that's able to produce that. So psilocybin, this psychedelic substance, comes from magic mushrooms, and in this country we're not allowed to pick magic mushrooms or use them in any way. So all the these substances have to be produced in the lab, as it were.
Yeah, the obstacles to it are extraordinary. I mean, £100,000 to be able to, it's just to buy the drugs, right? Just to be able to use them in on the subject is extraordinary. And it just makes it so much harder for them to actually be able to do any kind of research, because half of their, or a huge amount of their grant is gone just on buying some of the equipment, I suppose.
Exactly. That's about a fifth of what they have in total, So his... he's really trying to flag up this issue. I think in a way, although David Nutt is very powerful in getting this message across, I think there's also an element of him that, or an element of the way in which he presents his views, that close off discussion a little, just because they're so pro-drugs, as it were.
I can understand why he does that, though, because it must be so frustrating to want to do this research. And you can, I can imagine, you know, he knows, well, from the work that he's done, he's shown that there is something here to look into. And yet he just can't manage to get there because there's so many things that are blocking him from getting there. You know, it's so expensive. The police, I read that they can supposedly raid the lab any time randomly to be able to check that all the drugs are there. And they have all to have all these security that in place. And I think that must put people off doing that research.
Yeah, exactly. So there are only about four hospitals, I think, in the country that are allowed to stock these drugs legally, which is a bit silly. You can understand his frustration, because depression is quite a debilitating illness, and
Huge
it's something that's very, it's a very common illness across Europe. And something like 10% of people who have depression don't respond to any treatment at all. There is some treatment, but a worrying number of people just don't respond to it at all. So that's kind of the reason that he's trying
so
to look at.
So passionate about it. Yeah.
So passionate, yes, and trying to really explore all the other options.
Okay, so my story is about paleontologists in China finding a collection of dinosaur embryos. And in fact, it's the oldest dinosaur embryos they've ever found. And they're about 190 million years old. And the dinosaur, the species that they found, has a name which I am not going to be able to pronounce properly, but I think it's the Lufengosaurus dinosaur. And it was a herbivorous dinosaur in the early Jurassic period, roaming around China. It's about 9 meters, had one of those long necks, and it had very strangely short arms. You know, like Tyrannosaurus Rex has those arms that it wouldn't be able to put on its glasses if it had any?
It's like that.
And the interesting thing about these embryos is that they've been able to track them through their development, because they found embryos at different stages, all together in this collection of eggs.
So what did they find out about these embryos?
Well, we don't have the original research, but they claim that these dinosaurs would have had one of the shortest incubation times of any embryos, any dinosaur species they found so far. And they think that it's because they were trying to outgrow their predators. It might be the speed of their growth would have continued out of the egg, and that's why perhaps these dinosaurs would have grown so large.
Okay, so what else does that tell us about
it's just the very obvious thing that one of the ways that the dinosaurs would have tried to avoid predation is, I'm just going to be bigger than anything else that's around so that I can step on you.
So they that's quite a good rule for life, probably, if you're a dinosaur. So the articles that I read about this, they said that they found out that these dinosaurs were twitching inside their eggs.
They were wiggling around.
Yeah. How did they find that out? Or why did they think
Well, from what I gather from the paper, it's because the muscles were shaping the bones as they grow.
Ah, okay.
And that to be able to do that, they must have been able to move, to wiggle around. Cool. And that's the first, what's the earliest record of it. And I think it's something that they already suspected, because they know that birds do this in their egg. They wiggle around. And it's just nice, I think, to have the evidence to back that up.
So you talked about these dinosaurs with these tiny arms.
Yes.
Why did dinosaurs develop with tiny arms?
Not being a dinosaur myself, I'm not able to answer that question.
It just seems like... in an evolutionary kind of way, it doesn't sound like be that useful.
I think the answer is that people don't know. Paleontologists, there's so much about dinosaurs that we don't know yet. I mean, we only recently, I say we in the grand sense, scientists have only recently discovered that some dinosaurs had feathers, and that wasn't that long ago. Before then, I mean, imagine Jurassic Park, the film. None of those dinosaurs had feathers. And that was the idea that everybody had in their head of what a dinosaur looked like.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing how paleontology throws up these things that completely change prehistoric landscapes in our minds. And I think this is just why I find this paper so interesting, because it's because they can you can compare them to birds that wiggle around. Just thinking of dinosaurs in that way makes them seem more realistic, more believable, and nearer to us, even though they were so many millions of years ago. Now, another striking story on The Guardian this week was covered by Oliver Wainwright, who writes about architecture and design. The piece was a look at an emerging science in molecular engineering, 4D printing, where materials are designed to assemble themselves. And I'm delighted to say Oliver has joined me in the studio to tell me more. Hello, Oliver. It's great to have you in the studio today. Can you tell me, what is 4D printing?
I can try to, yes. 4D printing is essentially the next kind of horizon after 3D printing. It's a bit of a misnomer, I think, using the term 4D, because it implies a kind of secret dimension that we don't know about. It essentially means a 3D printed object with the addition of time after it's been printed. So it's about objects and materials that can change, that almost have a kind of smart sense built into them. So once something's been printed out, it can adapt and kind of modify itself to its environment.
And it modifies itself to a certain design, is that right? So it's guided by something.
It's all kind of pre-programmed, and the people that have been developing it at MIT describe it as programmable matter. So rather than kind of computer programming, it's about programming objects. So you can kind of specify the particular material properties of certain parts of these objects, and then the 3D printer knows kind of what proportions and where to put these materials, and which means that once the object's printed out, those particular parts of the object can react to a stimulus. And I think in this case, they've been using water. So it's a new polymer that expands when it meets water. And the kind of object they've been testing it with looks essentially like a straw, and it has these kind of joints all the way along it. So when you dip it in water, they react differently, and it kind of folds itself into a cube. So, I mean, it's fairly simple for the time being, but I think the potentials of, you know, smart materials, programmable matter, developing objects that could almost take on a life of their own after they've been printed is quite incredible.
And you come from an architecture and design background, so what kind of applications could this be put to?
Well, MIT have so far been talking about self-assembling furniture, the idea that in the future you might be able to go to IKEA, buy a kind of vacuum-sealed container, take it home, open the seal, and then it will react to the air, and a chair might kind of fold itself into being or expand into existence.
I think that is my dream, because I have spent so many hours wrestling with IKEA furniture, I cannot tell you.
And
I
always end up, easier.
Definitely, I always end up with that, you know, that horrible moment when you finish whatever it is, the wardrobe, the chest of drawers, and you realise that half of the screws aren't in the actual piece. And you don't know, you know that at some point the door's going to fall off, but you don't know when.
Never have that problem ever again. I think the more exciting thing to me is kind of infrastructural potential, and Skylar Tibbetts, who's the architect that has been developing this technology at MIT, was describing a future of kind of water mains infrastructure, where at the moment we have fixed capacity pipework, which means that if demand increases or ground conditions change, you have to essentially dig up the earth and kind of start from scratch and replace the physical pipe. With kind of multi-material 3D printed pipework, the kind of programmed pipe, you could essentially have a cross-section of a pipe that adapts according to flow rate, so potentially a pipe that gets bigger, that contracts along its length to kind of push the water through in the manner of peristalsis in the human intestine. So it's those kind of infrastructural applications, I think, that could be incredibly revolutionary.
And what timescale are we talking about?
I think things like that will be a long way in the future. I mean, at the moment, it's a plastic straw that can bend itself in water. You know, maybe one day you'll dip your sofa into a bathtub and it will kind of grow. But I mean, I think infrastructural properties are going to be a while yet. I think what could happen a lot sooner is kind of architectural elements, things like facades, smart facades that maybe adapt.
What's a smart facade?
Well, if you imagine you could have a kind of cladding system that changed its properties in response to rain, so a system that maybe folded to create downpipes to channel the water somewhere on the building. They've been talking about coffee cups, which can change their shape according to the temperature of the coffee, things like that. So I think maybe we'll start to see those smaller scale applications first.
Well, thank you very much, Oliver. It's really interesting.
You're welcome. Thanks.
A huge thanks to Maria Bocciarova and Oliver Wainwright. You can read all of Oliver's writing at guardian.co.uk/design. And to find out more about Maria's work at UCL's Complex Department, we'll have a link to her site on our weekly blog.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, Venezuela's new president. Who is Nicolas Maduro? Russell Brand on Margaret Thatcher. I always felt sorry for her children. Our audiobook review turns to non-fiction with Ahmed Arachidi's account of his time in Guantanamo Bay and a parable of innovation from Vijay Govindarajan and Chris Trimble. To subscribe for free to the Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud, iTunes and Audioboo. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Understanding materials at the nano level is, as we've heard, a powerful new area of science. One of the leading researchers into how we observe materials at the atomic level is Professor Pratibha Ghai from the University of York. She's also this year's winner of the prestigious L'Oréal UNESCO for Women in Science Prize. She joins me down the line to talk about her award and her research. Well, first of all, Pratibha, congratulations on
your award.
It's wonderful. Such a prestigious award for women in science.
Yes, I'm very honoured.
What does it mean for you and your research to win this?
First of all, you know, I'm very honoured to receive the L'Oréal UNESCO Women in Science Award. The award basically puts women scientists' research on the world stage. You know, personally, this award will help with my research funding for further work, and also help me to travel to international conferences to see what advances are being made and to buy some minor research items for my research work. Basically, you know, it puts my research on the world stage, and that's tremendously important.
Yes, and Professor, women are underrepresented at the level of science that you're doing. In your experience, what do you think it is that is holding women back, and what can we do to encourage more younger women to take up science as a career?
You know, obviously women are underrepresented in science, especially in the physical sciences. Societal and family expectations of what is better for women may not always include scientific studies in many parts of the world, including the UK, I might add. And so, you know, there are obviously some gender and institutional barriers. But awards like L'Oréal UNESCO Women in Science Award, you know, help put women's research on the world stage, so they have somebody to look up to now. So there are role models for them, and I think you know, that's an excellent thing.
You say that the importance of having women role models. Could I ask who your role models were when you were starting out?
Unfortunately, when I started out, there were no female role models, and so that was very difficult in the early stages of my career. But with sheer determination and hard work, you know, I knew I could do it. And so that's why now at least things are improving. And as I said, there are role models for young women to look up to. And there are incentives for, you know, institutions and universities now to employ and retain women scientists. So that's a good thing. So things are improving, but we have some way to go yet.
So could you tell me a little bit about why you won the award? I gather it's to do with a new electron microscope that you invented. What did you do to the old microscope?
Okay, first of all, you know, have you ever wondered about how medicines we take and the energy we use and many of the things we use in our everyday life come about? They all come from chemical reactions. In fact, human body is full of chemical reactions and our blood is a chemical. And chemical reactions basically take place between substances of different kinds. And these chemical reactions are the backbone of human healthcare and technology, which are at the heart of modern society. And, you know, they take place at the fundamental level, which is the atomic level. And what are the atoms? Atoms are the basic building blocks of everything we see in the world. They're basic building blocks of matter. But they are about 1/10 of 1 billionth of a meter in size, right? In other words, they're extremely small, invisible to the human eye. In order to understand these chemical reactions better, one needs to observe them directly at the atomic level. This better understanding is important in the development of new medicines and new antibiotics for human healthcare, cleaner energy sources with less environmental impact and better industrial products for the benefit of humanity and to transform society. That's why studying these chemical reactions at the atomic level which they take place is very important. And this is where my invention comes in, you know, to observe chemical reactions at the atomic level. I developed a special microscope called Atomic Resolution Environmental Transmission Electron Microscope, or Atomic Resolution ETEM for short, with full analytical functionality, which for the first time enables the human eye to watch these chemical reactions at the atomic level as they take place, to understand these reactions better in order to help develop new medicines and cleaner energy sources.
What does that look like when you're looking through the lens? Say if we had one here and we looked through, what would we be seeing?
We would be seeing atoms at work, atoms doing their business, doing chemical reactions. And what we do is to then put the image these on the CCD camera and then put it, display it on the PC monitor. So, you can see it, and I would like to welcome you to come and see it in my lab.
Oh, I'd love to.
Demonstrate.
Thank you.
Okay, just a little bit to answer your question. What was the problem with the old microscope? You know, earlier our old microscope, which we call conventional microscopes, work with no atmosphere. They work in vacuum. I'm talking about electron microscope. They're just like light microscope, to put it simply, but instead of light, we use electrons to get resolution. And they work, conventional microscopes work with no atmosphere, i.e. in vacuum and at room temperature, and they look at stationary or dead materials. And old ETEMs also did not give atomic resolution, whereas chemical reactions are alive like you and me, you know, in their own gases, temperatures, and liquid environments. They're constantly changing at the atomic level, so we call them dynamic. And in technology, many chemical reactions take place in gas, temperatures, or liquids on surface atoms of materials known as catalysts, which speed up chemical reactions. Instead of waiting, say, for 2 months or 2 years, we can do the reactions in 2 hours, for example. And I try to unlock mysteries of the changing atomic world in chemical reactions. And obviously, observing atoms at work is a formidable challenge. It's like looking at a moving golf ball on the surface of the moon from the Earth, right? So many people said that it was not possible to do, but I was curious about it and I decided to do it. And I started very carefully, obviously, and working it all out since no one had managed to do it before. And I carried out calculations and built a mock-up apparatus to make the tests first. And my scientific illumination came when I realized that it was possible to drill a hole on the side of the electron microscope through its imaging lens. It's like drilling a hole through its heart, right?
How expensive was the machine that you were drilling a hole in?
The machine was up to about, say, £1 million or so.
That's very brave.
Yeah, so very obviously, that's why I did all the calculations and mock-up apparatus to introduce reaction environment. But, you know, the payoff has been tremendous. We have made... it has brought benefits of hundreds of millions of dollars, right? So 1 million is nothing. But we had to, because nobody had done this before, we had to do it very carefully. And obviously, we took we had to take some intelligent risks in science to advance it anyway. And so, as I said, we drilled the hole through its imaging lens to introduce reaction environments of gas and temperatures and liquids and still have it work at the atomic level. And one day, you know, I was alone in my lab testing this microscope with full analytical functions, and I saw for the first time in the world atoms working in a chemical reaction, changing the atomic structure, and that was absolutely thrilling. And basically, you know, it opened up a whole new field of studying materials actually working in chemical reactions at the atomic level, and has given scientists a real-time view into the complex atomic world of chemical reactions.
So can we talk about what are the applications? So what has come out
and
in this research?
First of all, my application, my invention is now adopted for commercial production, and it's validated and used by researchers worldwide in many areas of science and technology, bringing more benefits to society with economic benefits of more than $200 million. And secondly, with the special microscope, I discovered an atomic scale reaction site mechanism to solve the riddle of how gas molecules actually move on the catalyst surface, to show that surface is rearranged by simple atomic movement. And this mechanism is important in the development of medicines, antibiotics for healthcare, efficient production of biofuels and industrial products, including polymers. And other applications include, the development of tiny antibiotic nanoparticles in human healthcare, for example, for surgery, medical implants, and to control bacterial infections in healthcare settings and in the human body generally. And the invention has also led to the development of a new chemical process for renewable biofuels from vegetable plant like rapeseed oil, and now we are increasingly using weeds and grass. You know, grass nobody wants, so we are trying to convert that into biofuels to combat climate change and energy shortages.
Okay, and so for all of these technologies, are we talking about a long time in the future? We're going to be able, they're going to be used widely, or is this already happening?
It's already happening, and it's continuing to grow. And so that's the nice thing about the invention, because we can now look at these materials actually working, so we can then develop them in a more efficient way or come up with completely new systems. And what's happening now is that we can now actually see single atoms. So my dream is actually train these atoms to actually come up with some revolutionary new medicine that we have not thought about yet, right? And so everything is happening, and everything leads to further advances. So that's where we are at the present time.
That sounds very exciting. Thank you so much, Professor, for telling me about all of your research, and congratulations again on winning your award.
Thank you very much. As you know, in fact, women make up 50% of the population, and more women in science means more benefits to the world, and that's my vision. And basically, nature is science, and science is teaching us about the world we live in and how to make it better. And collectively, we can make it better.
You're absolutely right. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you so
much. It's lovely
to
speak to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. A huge thank you and congratulations to Professor Guy. To find out more about her work and about the award, have a look on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. That's all for this week. Do join us next week. But from me, Camilla Ruse, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.